Good afternoon, and welcome to Line One, your health connection on KSK Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. We are only just beginning to understand the complexities of the mind, the way in which people respond to trauma, and the experiences of healing. Understanding the connection between early adverse childhood experiences, especially trauma, abuse, and neglect, has helped us to establish the clear link between these and later mental health difficulties, social problems, relationship issues, substance abuse, self-harm, and even crime. Because I like that statement so much, I took it from the website of today's guest, Kimber Olson. I hope that's okay. Today on Line One, Kimber is going to give us an education about dissociative disorders and the sometimes self-destructive behavior that goes along with them. We'll also look at the best treatment options if you or someone you love suffers from any of the things we discussed today. Kimber obtained her bachelor's in social work in 1995, her master's degree in 1997, and was licensed at the clinical level with her LCSW in 2001. She has a wide variety of experience, including work as a child protection social worker, volunteer guardian ad litem, and a rape crisis hotline volunteer. She's worked in outpatient community mental health centers, long-term psychiatric and substance abuse residential treatment programs, and now in private practice. Kimber has provided trainings nationally and internationally in areas of trauma, sexual abuse, attachment, ethics, compassion fatigue, physically and sexually aggressive youth, dissociation, and eating disorders. Kimber holds advanced certification in critical incident stress management, is trained in eye movement desensitization and reprocessing therapy, or EMDR, for those of you who might not know, and is a member of the International Society for the Study of Trauma and Dissociation, and is chair for the Alaska Component Group of the ISSTD. What is the ISSTD, Kimber? Let's just educate people right off the bat with that.
Okay, sounds good. ISSTD is the International Society for the Study of Trauma and Dissociation. It is an international group of some of the most amazing and compassionate people who are authors and lecturers and researchers in the area of both trauma, complex trauma, and dissociation. And that group really looks at trying to assist emerging professionals, people who have experienced trauma, and to provide education to folks about trauma and dissociation.
So that's a really good resource and one that's available on our website.
It is, absolutely.
All right. Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to join us today. It's great having you here.
Thanks so much.
I know this is a lot of work and you're busy. Before we get rolling, I want to let people know how to reach us. You can call locally at 550-8433. Or if you're outside Anchorage, you can reach us toll free at 1-888-353-5752. And the last way is to email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. Remember, you got to spell that out. That's L-I-N-E-O-N-E. Please don't hesitate to call in or email your thoughts because it makes for a better show when you participate. All right, Kimber, I like to start off by asking people why they choose to do what they do. I'm always curious as to why we get into the lines of work that we're in. And you wrote on your website something that jumped out at me. You said, perhaps the most important thing for you to know about me is that I love what I do. I have huge respect for the people who are willing to come into a therapist's office and share their inner world. This is vulnerable, frightening, and can be life-changing, though it's rarely easy. I'm honored to be a part of it. So why put that on your website? Why is it important for people to know that we, as therapists, generally really love what we do?
Well, I think it's so important because I get to experience something and to witness something that most people don't get to witness. And I think it is absolutely one of the most courageous acts anyone can do. Frankly, in a therapy office with the door closed, the kinds of things that we are sharing are the kinds of things that we don't want anybody else to know. And right. They're really tough things to work through. And I'm honored to be a part of that process. I think it is amazing, courageous work.
It is quite an honor to see people's lives evolve and to change and to witness, really. I mean, to witness their pain and their growth. So I appreciate you doing what you do. Let's get to dissociative disorders in just a second. But one of the things we're going to probably recommend therapy at the end of this, like for people, like what do we do about this? So one of the things I want to get out of the way right off the bat is how do people find a therapist? Like, let's just start there. If you're looking for a therapist and you've never done it before, like, how do you know what's good? How do you know? Because it's an art, what we do.
Right. My friend Noah Rubenstein has a website called goodtherapy.org. Okay. And on that website, you can find a number of therapists who have a particular belief that respect in the client and a partnership with a client is really important in therapy. And for trauma survivors, I think that's incredibly important. So that's one good resource. You can look up folks on the ISSTD website who have some experience and some training in trauma and in dissociation. And the other thing I would do is to look up particularly areas of specialty for whomever you may be looking for. And then I would ask the therapist on the phone their style and what they think is important in therapy. And if they're willing to do a 20 or 30 minute session for free with you to just connect and see if your styles will match. I think all of those things are very important.
I was going to ask that. So it's important and it's fair to, if you want, to talk to a therapist before you begin the intake process and get all embroiled in the therapeutic process, because it is, I mean, it's a lot of work to get there and to open up and to trust somebody.
It is. It's a lot of work. And I think, you know, that chemistry, that relationship between the therapist and the client is so predictive of changes being made in therapy. And so if you're going to somebody or you start to initiate a relationship with a therapist and it just doesn't click, you know, most of us have the ego strength to be okay and say, right, that's what's most important is that you are with a therapist that is going to fit for you. And, you know, you may not like the smell in my room or the colors in my room. And if it doesn't fit for you, it's important that you go to somebody that does fit for you.
Above all, it's comfort and safety and security. I think I was going to ask, is it more important that a therapist know a particular intervention or style or like being trauma informed, or that the relationship is trusting and nurturing and safe?
You know, there's actually been some studies done on that, and Scott Miller and Barry Duncan have some great research in that area that really demonstrate that it is the relationship, that in fact specific techniques do have some efficacy, but they're far, they are not nearly as important as the relationship. And it's not the way the therapist views the relationship, it's right, the way the client views the relationship, whether or not they feel respected and whether or not they feel like it's a partnership.
So it doesn't matter if we think we're doing a good job.
It really doesn't, it turns out.
They have to. Yeah. All right, well, before we get into the talking points, we have a early caller. We got, is it Stephen? We got, you're on the air.
No, it's Stefan.
Oh,
thank
sorry.
You.
Go ahead, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Hi, Kimber. This is Stefan. I'm wondering, do you have any comments or knowledge about the exponential rise of false allegations that are made during divorces, about those personality types and how prolific it's become? Do you have anything that you could enlighten me with on that?
You know, what a great question. And I really don't. That really is not my area of expertise. You know, that certainly can happen. But that's not something that I really have a lot of expertise in.
Okay, well, real good. Well, thank you very much, and have a nice afternoon. Bye-bye.
You too.
Thanks, Stefan. I will tell you, Stefan, there's a really good website. It's the High Conflict Institute. Bill Eddy is the founder and started the High Conflict Institute in San Diego, California. He was a guest on our show. I did a show on high conflict people, and he has a book about the high conflict divorce. And that's probably the kind of thing you're talking about, is false allegations of abuse and physical stuff. So I would encourage you to look that up, read up on Bill Eddy and some of his work on divorce. So appreciate the call, and we'll get back to dissociative disorders. Okay, so see if I can find my starting point now. So let's start off, I guess, with this concept of disorganized attachment that last week Dr. Van der Kolk touched on it briefly. He just kind of mentioned it. We were covering a really broad area, but disorganized attachment, what does that mean for folks just out there listening?
Okay, so Mary Ainsworth did some studies, and many people know about this study. It's called the Strange Situation Study, in which she took toddlers about 18 months of age and put them into a room with their parent, had the parent leave the room for two separate one-minute time periods. And what she looked at was how the toddler experienced the separation and, most importantly, how they experienced the parent coming back into the room. And just really briefly, what she found are some children have a secure attachment to their parent, and they really feel a connection. They feel like they're safe. They feel like their parents are able to soothe them. They feel secure in that relationship. And then some kids had an insecure avoidant, and some kids had an insecure anxious style, and then some kids had this disorganized style.
Okay.
So in children, the style depends on the relationship with each individual parent. And as we become adults, that style becomes more and more fixed. In kids, what we see with disorganized attachment is when their parent would come back into the room, they may actually run to the parent, but then pull immediately away from them. Or they may start to go toward their parent and then curl up in a ball and cry or become aggressive. They had this push-me-pull-me behavior. And what started to be understood, and it wasn't actually in Ainsworth's first studies, later we discovered this disorganized attachment style. What we understood is that these children felt very unworthy. They felt frightened of their parents, or they felt this real pull between wanting to go to their parents for comfort and then feeling like they couldn't go to their parents for comfort, either because their parents were too frightened and showed the children that, or they were frightening.
You're talking an inner conflict. Those are polar opposites in a child's mind. I want to go to, but I'm afraid of.
Absolutely. And what happens is we have a couple of different systems internally. One system is the system of attachment, and another system is the system of safety. And unfortunately, in some cases, but fortunately in many others, what happens is that attachment will trump safety. And so kids will then do what they need to be able to maintain the attachment to their parents, even when their parents may be abusive or neglectful or very anxious and frightened themselves or frightening. And what kids do is they blame themselves. So they begin to feel unworthy. They have an incredibly difficult time managing their own emotions. They have an overwhelming anxiety. And this disorganized pattern, if it is not addressed, then in later childhood, they may become unmanageable or they may dissociate. So this is a sort of a foundation, one way that kids can become incredibly vulnerable to dissociation.
And kids don't have any choice but to attach, because biologically, I guess attachment has to trump, I guess you said it, trump safety, although it doesn't, because it is required for safety.
Yeah, it's a really interesting combination, right? But
yeah.
So there's this, actually the safety is to maintain the attachment, even if it means maintaining an attachment in this sort of trauma bond way with a person who may be hurting them or maybe not taking care of them.
But they'll probably keep them alive.
What happens when we're little babies is we have to depend on our parents, whether or not they are providing us with all of the things that we may need for survival or for growth. But we need them for survival.
Right. There's nobody that a kid can call and say, hey, you know, I'd like to trade these folks in.
That's right.
They're not
That's
so great.
Right. No. Nope.
I got sold a bill of goods. Okay. So how does trauma, I guess we sort of touched on that, but can you go a little bit deeper into how trauma impacts that attachment early on?
Right. Absolutely. So one of the things we found is that with adults, through an adult attachment inventory process, we found that adults have this category that is similar to disorganized attachment. It's called unresolved trauma. And 80% of children whose parents were rated as unresolved trauma then developed disorganized attachment. And we found that these kids with disorganized attachment, there's a statistically significant predictor of dissociation by the age of 19. So trauma really impacts all the systems. It impacts the way we think. It impacts our ability to manage our emotions. It impacts our body functions and our sensations. It impacts our social relationships. It really impacts every bit of who we are as people.
All right, so we're going to jump right into dissociation after. I remind folks who might be tuning in late that my guest today is Anchorage therapist Kimber Olson, who specializes in treating complex trauma and dissociative disorders. Our area of focus for today's show is dissociative disorders. You can reach us with your questions or comments at our local phone number. That's 550-8433, or call us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. Or you can email us your questions at line1@alaskapublic.org, and I'll read those on the air if you get them in early enough. All right, so the different types of, well, let's describe dissociation. Like, what is that? What does that even mean? Like,
that's a really hard concept because, you know, Richard Kloft, who's really the grandfather currently of our understanding clinically and in terms of research of dissociation, has identified that there are at least 23 current approaches to defining or describing dissociation. So it's kind of complicated. We could spend a lot of time on this. But I love this quote by E.R. Hilgard from 1973, where the quote says, "Daily life is full of many small dissociations if we look for them." What's interesting is we don't look for them, right? And we don't notice them. I'm probably dissociating right now as we're talking online because, public speaking is most people are afraid of it more than they are of death. So
it's the number one.
When I leave, I may not remember all of the things I said. Another just normal way of dissociating is right now I'm not thinking about what my kids are doing or how safe they are. If I thought all day of what my kids were doing and how safe they are in their environments, I would go crazy because I wouldn't be able to leave them. So that's another just real mild form of dissociation. As we get into more moderate forms of dissociation, we find that trauma can cause dissociation. For instance, amnestic fugue. Amnestic fugue can happen. It is very frequently found in wartime or other traumatic experiences. Mm-hmm. That's sort of when, you know, you find somebody wandering off and they don't know where they've been and they don't remember who they are. But it can happen in small ways every day. And so there's a lot of normal dissociation that happens with trauma. For instance, Abraham Lincoln had an experience of depersonalization where during the campaign, he saw himself standing many yards away from himself. So that's an example of depersonalization. So there's five kinds of dissociation. And the first kind is that amnesia or memory problems involved in basic personal information. That can be not remembering a trip you went on. It can be not remembering who you are. It might just be very simple and small things. Depersonalization is kind of a sense of detachment from your body. Sometimes people feel they don't have a body, or my arm is doing something, but I don't know why it's doing that, or I don't experience that as my arm.
It's not your personal self? I mean,
it's an interesting, it's kind of trance logic. So I might know I have a body, but I don't feel like I have a body, or I don't feel like it's attached to me, or perhaps I feel like it's robotic, or I'm watching myself go through the motions. Kind of the classic is, when somebody experiences a trauma and they feel like they're floating up to the ceiling and watching themselves.
Yeah.
And so that's a depersonalization. Derealization is when you experience familiar things as if they are unfamiliar. For instance, seeing your parent and knowing they're your parent, but not feeling like they're your parent, or walking into a room you know very well and feeling as if you don't know where you're at.
Is it a disconnection from emotions or attachment?
Yeah, so this is interesting. The way we experience dissociation is Buddy Braun in 1984 created this model, and it's called BASC, and it means behavior, affect, sensations, and knowledge. So if we have a full memory of something, we remember what we did and what other people did. We remember what the body sensations were and how we experienced that physically. We remember how we felt, and we also have some meaning or knowledge of what the situation was about. You can dissociate any part of that so that somebody may have a memory. This happens sometimes in flashbacks or in panic attacks where a person experiences, say, what's called a felt emotion. All of a sudden they feel an incredible amount of grief, but they don't know where that's coming from. So that would be an experience of dissociating the meaning or the behavior, but still having the feeling right there.
It's a complex thing to understand. So everyday dissociation we all engage in, that's what you described as like when, one that's maybe a little bit more extreme is like the very first radio show I ever did solo without Dr. Woodard here. I had a couple friends on, and I don't remember a single thing from that show. I just remember leaving here with this sense that it was awful. Yes. And that I had put the worst hour of radio on the air ever that was created. And then I went away and it was awful. And then trauma, like I was, and everybody's saying it was fine. I was like, don't call me, don't talk to me. But then when I listened to it, it was okay. But I realized I hadn't remembered most of what was said. It was like this blur because I was so anxious and so focused on the task at hand.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So one of the things that can happen is a hyper focus. Hyper focus on one thing. And actually, we do this all day. We tune out other things. You and I right now are tuning out things so that we can focus on this conversation. We're tuning out all kinds of things, including probably some body sensations, sounds, smells, in order to focus on what we're doing.
So it's quite normal.
It is.
And if we didn't, if we didn't dissociate at some level, we would just be bombarded with too much information to
be able
to handle.
Yeah, absolutely.
So your brain disconnects from certain things. So is that why it becomes a defensive strategy? If your brain has that capacity to disconnect, it disconnects from traumatic memories?
So there's mild dissociation, which is what we're talking about. More moderate dissociation might be that depersonalization and derealization. It moves into a disorder. You can have a depersonalization disorder if that's chronic and also includes some derealization. Then that can move into identity confusion or an inner struggle. And this isn't kind of like the adolescent struggle that we've all gone through, not knowing who we are,
right?
Or some of us still later in life. But really thinking, you know, feeling like I have this set of strong feelings and beliefs in one moment and then another strong set of feelings and beliefs at another moment. And then the other piece is identity alteration or a sense of acting and feeling and thinking like a different person. So as you move into more moderate kinds of dissociation and then severe dissociation, what you're asking about is when there's a trauma, if it's too much for the person to experience either physically or emotionally or sensorially, then what happens is that person just kind of dissociates as an incredibly creative and intelligent coping skill.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely the best thing that they can do because that helps them to survive. It's as if what they were experiencing was actually, if they knew what they knew, they wouldn't be able to survive. They wouldn't be able to handle the situation. So when our coping skills cannot deal with what's going on, then a person can dissociate.
And that's what Dr. Van der Kolk talked about, when people lack a sense of agency and they're stuck in a traumatic environment over time without the sense that they can act on their own behalf.
Yes.
To rescue themselves.
Yes.
That's when people dissociate. Is that more common?
Well, so that's one way a person can dissociate. And if a person has dissociated a lot, they may come to believe that, in fact, they don't have any ability to change the way that their life is going. They feel like they may feel unworthy. They have very extreme emotions that they maybe don't have access to at all times, and then can feel very overwhelmed by those emotions.
So how would a person know if they have a dissociative disorder, a moderate one? Like, what would you see in a person? What would family and friends see in that person, like behaviorally? Because it could overlap with substance abuse problems, with anxiety disorders, with depression, with bipolar. I mean, take your pick.
Right.
What is the chicken or the egg thing? Which comes first and how do you know?
Well, so one way to think about it is to assess for trauma.
Okay. Right? So that's so the first thing you look for, history of trauma.
You want to look for history of trauma. Yep. But of course, you can have a comorbid dissociative disorder with something else like bipolar or anxiety. Generally, when people come into therapy, they don't come in even knowing they have a dissociative disorder because that would defeat the whole purpose of a dissociative disorder, right? Because then they would already know what they know. And dissociation is not knowing what you know. So what people might look for is... gosh, this is really hard because it's kind of like those commercials, you know, you get a checklist of 10 things and then you think, oh my gosh, I'm really depressed. I didn't know I was depressed.
Yeah, you get on WebMD and you have all sorts of things from,
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. But so you could look for a trauma history. You can look for memory gaps, especially for recent or for very important or historical events, like not remembering the birth of your child. You can look at, apparent age or personality and style changes. You know, one way of dissociating is when you see people just sort of look like they check out or are daydreaming, or just really spaced out, not remembering what you just said to them. Or you may say something to them and then they may kind of look at you like, and there may be a pause and they might say, what? What did you just say?
My wife is going to get me treated for this.
She's absolutely.
Right. She's going to be like, that's what you have.
And that's kind of the, you know, it's hard to sometimes give these kinds of symptoms because we don't want people to think, oh my gosh, now
that's
this is
also
what's going on for
deficit,
my kid, right?
Attention deficit disorder and depression in teenagers.
Absolutely. But also the most frequently misdiagnosis of children who have dissociative disorders is ADHD.
Yeah.
Now, I don't want, you know, everybody whose kid's diagnosed with ADHD to think, oh no, maybe it's dissociation. It actually looks very different neurologically, but that can be a misdiagnosis. In adults, it's bipolar or borderline personality disorder, right? But so, yes, we really do want to look at the trauma history, and then we do want to do some assessments. There are some very good, valid, reliable assessments for assessing dissociative disorders. But if you're sort of wondering just on your own, I would suggest looking at the book by Marlene Steinberg called Stranger in the Mirror. Okay. And it actually has some checklists and some assessments in that book, as well as describing it. Marlene Steinberg is the person who developed the SCID-D, and that is the gold standard of assessment for dissociative disorders.
Now, are these assessments that any therapist could, without any big special training, sort of do is like a checklist thing if you're...
Well, the dissociative experiences checklist is on the web and any therapist can do that. And you can even get a score, but none of the assessments will give you a diagnosis.
Right.
No, they suggest that it's something to then use your clinical interpretation for. So anybody can do the dissociative experiences scale, the DES. For the MID-6 or the SCID-D, you actually do need some additional training to do those.
All right. Now, DID, dissociative identity disorder, right? Used to be multiple personality disorder,
right.
Correct? Can
mm-hmm.
you explain the change there?
Well, yeah. So the change there was when the group of folks were looking at dissociation and looking at the DSM, one of the things they realized was that multiple personality disorder really doesn't describe what's going on because people don't have multiple personalities inside themselves.
Right.
The personality is the whole context of everything that the person is presenting, including the separate parts or alters. And those may have very different experiences. In fact, they can have their whole they can have whole sets of their own memories, belief systems, and experiences. Mary Reynolds in 1812 was the first documented case of multiple personality disorder. But in fact, we have documentation back into the middle 1600s. And for the last 150 years, actually increasingly empirical evidence and really good scientific studies now to really validate that what's now called dissociative identity disorder is in fact a valid diagnosis.
Because that was a huge debate for quite some time. I'd like to touch base on that again when we come back. Maybe we'll start with a little bit more about DID. But right now we're at the halfway point, so we're going to go ahead and take a short break. I want to remind you that you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSK Anchorage. Our topic today is dissociative disorders. If you have a question for our guest, you can reach us at 550-8433, or you can call toll-free at 353-5752, or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, we'll continue our conversation with Kimber Olson. I'm Prentice Pemberton.
You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1, Your Health Connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSK Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. If you're just joining us, my guest today is Kimber Olson. Kimber is an expert in the areas of trauma, child development, and dissociative disorders. Today, we are focusing on dissociation. I want to remind listeners that Dr. Woodard will continue to host Line 1 3 Mondays each month, and I will continue to host a show typically the last Monday of every month on some topic related to mental health. Remember, you can email your questions or comments about today's topic to line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call locally at 550-8433 or toll free at 1-888-353-5752. Remember that the show repeats tonight at 9. If you're listening to this on Monday night, you'll be hearing a taped recording and we won't be accepting phone calls. All right. Before the break, we talked a little bit about DID. We sort of touched on it, how it's the multiple personality disorder, the old, everybody knew about multiple personality disorder, right? Because it was just the crazy person, the person who had this person over here who killed people and this person who, and they couldn't remember and they couldn't communicate. What is the newest sort of research and indications of what that whole experience is about on that end of the spectrum?
Right. So, Billy Milligan is pretty well known, as well as Sybil and the Three Faces of Eve. And
who is Billy Milligan for those people who might not?
So Billy Milligan passed away in 2012, but I think it was the 70s. He was the first person to successfully use the guilty by reason of insanity plea for multiple personality disorder.
Right.
He had committed some crimes that he, one part of his personality could not remember, one part of him could not remember. That is no longer being used people can no longer use the guilty by reason of insanity for a dissociative identity disorder effectively. But that was who Billy Milligan was. And in fact, Leonardo DiCaprio is going to depict him in a movie, in an upcoming movie. I think it's called The Crowded Room. So,
Makes sense.
Yeah. Yes, right, right. More recently, The United States of Tara is a movie that is really interesting and it's fabulous to watch. And Richard Kluft was actually one of the people who helped, was a consultant for that. And he was asked, in fact, you can YouTube him and there's an interview, and he was asked, how real is this? And he said, it's very, very real. It's just not very realistic in terms of the way that Tara is floridly switching. Most people who have dissociative identity disorder don't have florid switches.
What do you mean? Extreme.
Yes, yeah. Right. So where you would look like you're switching to a young child and then...
You could see it.
Yeah, right. If you could see it, then it wouldn't protect the system. It wouldn't protect the person. And dissociation that's happening for young children, they're trying not to know what they know. And if they were very florid in their switching, then a lot of people would notice that and would question what was going on. And that would not benefit them in terms of how they're trying to protect themselves using dissociation.
All right, that makes sense. So dissociative identity disorder, it's a protective measure that people go through. It's not really, is it like alter egos? You know how people talk about their alter ego?
Right, right.
Like the guy that did this stuff is not me.
Yeah, sort of.
You know,
we all have parts.
Right. Okay, our parts.
Yeah, Richard Swartz does internal family systems therapy or parts therapy, uh-huh. And there's ego states therapy. The difference is I know when I'm acting like my 12-year-old self, and it's very integrated both neurobiologically as well as affectively. And behaviorally, if I'm acting in a certain way, I know that I'm acting in that way, right? I know that this is who I am. I know what it means about me. I know if I feel hijacked by a certain feeling or behavior. It's integrated. People who have dissociative identity disorder actually have different neurobiology, and we've been able to see that in fMRI studies and cardiovascular studies. And so neurobiologically, they are not integrated, neither vertically nor horizontally in terms of their brain functioning.
Their activity when under duress or just in general?
Just in general, actually, yes.
So they're wired differently. There's different activity going on.
That's right. But they're wired differently because of the trauma that they experienced. Or at least that's my belief, and that's the trauma model belief. Now, there is another camp, and that's called the fantasy model camp. And that's sort of an offshoot of the original camp, which was the sociocognitive model.
The fantasy camp.
Yeah.
This is kind of what it sounds like.
It is really what it sounds like. So, Paul McHugh, who's a former psychiatrist in chief for Johns Hopkins, and Elizabeth Loftus, who's done some research in memory, and also some other authors have looked at the fantasy model. And basically what they say is that DID is a social contagion, that it's picked up from the social media, from hypnotic suggestion, from misdiagnosis, and that people who are highly hypnotizable are therefore very suggestible, and that they have a high fantasy proneness. And so they are exposed to what we are all exposed to socially. And then they go into therapy, and therapists use coercive or interrogative or very persuasive or leading kinds of techniques with them. And then it creates this basically an iatrogenic diagnosis.
Yeah, what's that mean?
It means
iatrogenic.
Iatrogenic is created by the therapist, or iatrogenic illnesses are obtained when you're in the hospital.
Gotcha.
Right. So the fantasy model, one of their main beliefs is that people with DID are highly fantasy prone. So I have to tell you that in 2012, there's a fabulous study done that actually looked at that and said that in fact people with DID are no more fantasy prone than people without DID. And they took three groups of people with DID, people who are high fantasy prone, and people who are low fantasy prone. And they used these suggestive and coercive techniques with them to try to get them to act like somebody who had DID.
Uh-huh.
And they found that the low fantasy prone people were actually better at acting as if they had DID, but neither of them could do it. And they couldn't do it neurobiologically. They couldn't do it cardiovascularly. I'll give you all this information. I've got 6 pages of references I brought with me. You know, if anybody wants that. I really think people should look at this stuff on their own and should really determine for themselves what the research says. But we have more and more research that really is looking at the neurobiology being different, not at birth. It's different than, say, schizophrenia or bipolar, where there may be a true neurobiological difference.
More organic.
More organic. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But this really is a coping mechanism for trauma.
Okay, you have a quote by Stephen Levine on, is it Levine or Levine?
Oh, yeah, good question. Yeah.
All right, but the quote is, safety is the most unsafe path you can take. Safety keeps you numb and dead. People are caught by surprise when it's time to die. They have allowed themselves to live so little. That was like, that quote jumped out at me because mm-hmm. I think about like this trauma. It's, the more I look at this stuff, I was just listening to you talk, and this borderline personality disorder person that I and everybody else thought was borderline is probably dissociative, DID more likely. Mm-hmm. But is PTSD, is trauma underdiagnosed? I mean, it's all, it seems to be about big or small traumas. Is there a problem with the PTSD label being so like related to war and to violent things versus the methodic childhood neglect and trauma stuff, the complex right. trauma.
Right. So you had Bessel van der Kolk on your show last week, and Bessel really tried to get complex developmental trauma disorder into the DSM-5.
Yeah,
and
we talked
he was unsuccessful about that, with that. But that really does explain this kind of foundational vulnerability to dissociating, this disorganized attachment that can create this vulnerability, right? So there are different models of dissociation. Dissociation and dissociative disorders can occur later. But for the sake of the program, let's talk about this foundational model. So it is very different. Because it interferes incredibly with the person's ability to trust themselves and to trust others. And so it's a kind of a different type of PTSD. It's a very complex PTSD with memory holes in it. And so is it underdiagnosed? That's a good question. You know, I tend to see a lot of things. I look through things through a trauma lens. And people who come in with anxiety disorders or depression often also have some underlying trauma that they're working with, as opposed to, say, those organic disorders like a true psychosis or a bipolar.
Nature.
Right, more the nature versus nurture.
And it's a combination of things, obviously.
It is, but, it is, yeah. But, you know, the other piece of that is that when you ask, you know, what is trauma? Trauma really is whatever overrides your system. So if you think about that fight or flight system, when we experience some kind of trauma, if I experience trauma, I want to probably run away. That's the first human reaction. If we can't run, then we want to fight.
Right.
But if you think about somebody who's, let's say somebody who's under 5 years of age, they probably can't run away very well from what's going on in their home. And if they fight, they may be in more danger. And so what they do is they freeze. And neurologically, what happens with a freeze is it's what happens when, you know, sometimes, when an animal, the zebra is in the lion's mouth, right? And they kind of just freeze. It's what happens right before we die.
It's relaxed.
You just freeze. And freezing looks very calm on the outside, but it is actually an incredible hypoarousal. It's like, imagine mm-hmm. shaking, that like the shiver you get when you're freezing outside cold. So it's tons of arousal. And that, for little kids who have to freeze and can't get away, that sets the stage for dissociation. I've got to check out because I can't run away and I can't fight back.
And that becomes a lifelong pattern.
It can. It certainly can.
And like mm-hmm. with the idea of complex trauma, can you like explain that for folks who might need a little more clarification on what complex trauma is versus just trauma?
Sure. Sure. So you can have a diagnosis of PTSD, say, from a particular experience of life-threatening experience. And so you will have symptoms of avoiding the thinking about the trauma, and you may have experience of the trauma intrusive thoughts, memories, nightmares, those kinds of things. So it can be a single event, a single really awful event. Complex trauma is more the type of trauma that occurs relationally, probably with people that you should have been able to trust and count on, probably over many developmental milestones and different ages, probably at the hands of more than one person. And certainly when we're talking about dissociative disorder or dissociative identity disorder, what the research says is that people with that diagnosis, 90% of them have an established cooperative history of physical abuse, sexual abuse, and neglect.
Yeah.
And neglect absolutely can cause dissociation. In fact, medical problems, and we've got information now and research looking at dissociation based on medical complications and extensive medical histories in children. Because, it just overwhelms the system.
Dr. Van der Kolk pointed out that people with exposure to trauma in childhood live like 20 years less on average.
Right.
Because of all the medical complexities and the self-destructive behavior and the dissociative stuff and the drinking and it just goes from one thing to another. If you're just tuning in, my guest today is local therapist and trauma expert Kimber Olson. We're discussing dissociative disorders. As always, you can reach us with your questions at 550-8433 or toll free at 1-888-353-5752 or email to line1@alaskapublic.org. If you get them in the next 5 minutes or so, we can get them on the air. All right. So, yeah, he talked about the developmental trauma disorder, Dr. Van der Kolk did, and the difference. There must be a difference in treating it then, because I know what you're talking about. If you look at it through a trauma lens, you can almost, sometimes it's just bullying, like an episode of bullying from at a vulnerable age when you already had a tendency to low self-esteem that can traumatize somebody well into adulthood, I've found.
Mm-hmm. Actually, that's true. Yes, absolutely. And so there is a different treatment, and the treatment is stage or phase-oriented treatment. So the first phase is safety and stabilization. And safety and stabilization with somebody with a complex trauma history might take years.
Mm-hmm.
And then you look at trauma resolution. And trauma resolution might be using things like EMDR or sensory motor psychotherapy or trauma narratives. But that safety and stabilization piece, you're looking at grounding skills and pacing and reducing self-harm and reducing substance abuse. And you're looking at cognitive behavioral therapy and dialectical behavioral therapy, where you're helping change really core self-beliefs of, I'm not worthy. I don't deserve to be loved. I don't deserve to live. I shouldn't be here. Those kinds of really core beliefs that, need to be looked at. And then the third phase of treatment is really habilitation and integration into life. And so what we've found is, for instance, there's some new therapies that work incredibly well with PTSD that have to do with exposure therapies. And they've got great efficacy, great validity. They've got really good rates, except with complex trauma. And then they absolutely tank and they do more damage than good. And so it is actually a very different treatment.
It is. So how would a person start that? It's the thing that you mentioned that jumped out at me was that sense of safety. And sometimes that can take, that's where you're talking about the importance of the relationship with the therapist.
Yeah,
if they
absolutely.
Don't, if they're unable to connect and to feel that sense of security and safety, how could we expect them to unwrap the box?
Right. Absolutely. And I think it does take an incredible amount of time. And the concept, say, for instance, of trust is different. Mm-hmm. I don't expect people who are in my office to trust me. I might not even use that word, because the concept of trust doesn't make any sense if the people who you were supposed to count on and trust to take care of you didn't do that. Then why would anybody else?
If you can't count on your parents, why would you count on this guy that you just met?
That's right.
A couple months ago.
Yeah, absolutely. And so safety becomes things like, how's the temperature in my room? How is the lighting for you? Is my chair too close or too far away from you? What happens when you leave this room? Pacing again and not wanting to dig into those trauma memories or into the trauma work. And, you know, as therapists, that's kind of what we think we do. And especially if you're a trauma therapist, you may kind of dig in there a little bit, but you don't want to do that too fast or too soon. Richard Kluft says, the slower you go, the faster you get there. And that absolutely is the biggest key. And of course the relationship. Absolutely.
Yeah. I've noticed that if I try to make it on my time frame and I have an idea of what it is and I want to go get it, people are very resistant to it. But if they get there on their own time, because only when they're ready to be able to internalize it and to manage it emotionally, I think that sense of safety. So
right. And as a therapist, you also have to trust your client that, you know, your client is the expert on themselves. If you're working with a child, the parent is the expert on their own child. And kids know more even than we think they do. And so really trusting that what they're saying, if they're saying, I'm not ready for this, we need to trust that.
Oh, yeah. That's an important lesson for any professionals out there. I've heard it said that the Los Angeles County Prison is the largest mental health facility in the world. The link between early childhood trauma and future mental health problems. That's really strong and really imperative. And how does, I mean, as a, I'm pretty informed trauma-wise, but and I don't know nearly, I mean, I've learned so much, reading and researching for this program, and I was already pretty well informed, but wow, like, we don't know professionally. How are we missing stuff by not treating for trauma more often?
We are, absolutely. And you keep calling me an expert, and I'm not. I mean,
you seem like it to me.
Oh, thanks. Absolutely. The trauma-informed is the new buzzword.
Right.
But
yeah.
Even in the code of ethics of the NASW and the American Psychological Association, we're just barely touching on dissociation. And that what we've found is for people who have dissociative disorders, if you don't treat that, if you don't address it, they won't get better. They absolutely need a different type of treatment.
The anxiety won't resolve. The depression won't resolve.
Actually, what they'll find is the anxiety might resolve and the depression might resolve, but the deeper trauma history, those core self-beliefs, the way they interact with people, that mistrust of the world and of other people and of themselves, and that ability to soothe themselves doesn't change, that the dissociation keeps happening. And so absolutely, there's just starting to be some studies of men in prison. And looking at how many of them are dissociating, and it's high. It's pretty up there. The two people who have eating disorders and people who have substance abuse disorders are oftentimes are dissociating or are using those kinds of either the substance or the difficulties with eating to sort of check out in a different way.
So how do you know the difference there? Let's take drinking for an example. That's a great one. Somebody drinks to dissociate from their own suffering, or do they just drink? And then they suffer because they started drinking. I mean, what's the difference and how do you treat it differently?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. So, it's a chicken and an egg thing, right?
Yeah.
And it's hard to determine. But I think that biggest key is for us as therapists to become trauma-informed and to get to know what is dissociation and get to know those assessment tools and substance abuse providers as well, because we've had these silos and these camps where this is all I treat. And really, in a way, it's all the same thing. And we have to learn how to use each other's language and to communicate with each other and to do that assessment. But even people who are trauma-informed very often think dissociation is just that, like, checking out. Well, it's not. And so the answer to your question is really complex, and it's a kind of a it depends answer. But I think getting to know what dissociation is and understanding that it's real. You know, most of us, even I graduated from grad school 20 years ago, and even then we were being told dissociative disorders are extremely rare. You probably won't see one. You know, the people who are still the generation of folks who are teaching and training us didn't have that information, didn't have that knowledge. Now that we have neurobiology, there's studies that are being done. There's corroborative data. There's empirical evidence that this is, in fact, a real disorder, and this is occurring, and it's occurring more than we know. It's occurring in 1% to 3% of the population, the general population. And so
A diagnosable
dissociative disorder, either a DID or a depersonalization disorder, or a dissociative disorder not otherwise specified.
I see it very much as a protective way. You see the examples of, like, kids from war-torn areas or from concentration camps, and the looks in their eyes and the vacancy. They're just sort of, I mean, the human organism quits crying out for help if it doesn't get it, right?
Absolutely. And that's kind of what Van der Kolk was talking about, of that, and you were talking about last week, of that sense of agency, of just the belief that, well, I can't do it. I can't do anything to change my world. So there's that shutdown. Absolutely.
Okay, we are running up against the wall. So is there anything that you want to kind of leave folks with, or take home points or ideas or thoughts?
Yes, about another 2 days worth.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I guess I would say just a couple of things. One is I have tons of research. I have tons of information. If anybody wants to get in touch with me, I can send you my 6 pages of references.
Now, do we have your website on the online? It's just say it in case.
It's www.KimberOlsonLCSW.com. And I think you do.
Tough one to remember.
Yeah, that's
KimberOlsonLCSW.com.
But if I could, I'd just leave you with a quote. And I think the thing about this, one of the reasons it's so hard to accept dissociation is we don't want to know that we've collectively done harm. We don't want to know the harm others have suffered. And so the quote I'll leave you with is from J.K. Rowling's 2008 commencement address to Harvard graduates. And it is this: they can refuse to hear screams or to peer inside cages. They can close their minds and hearts to any suffering that does not touch them personally. They can refuse to know. I might be tempted to envy people who can live that way, except that I do not think that they have any fewer nightmares than I do. Choosing to live in narrow spaces leads to a form of mental agoraphobia, and that brings its own terrors. I think the willfully unimaginative see more monsters. They are more afraid. What is more, those who choose not to emphasize enable real monsters. For without ever committing an act of outright evil ourselves, we collude with it through our own apathy.
Wow. All right, we'll leave you with that. My thanks to today's guest, Kimber Olson, for an enjoyable hour. Please check out a variety of links and information we have available on today's topic. Just go to alaskapublic.org and click on the link to today's show. One thing I'd like to stress today is the part about taking the time to let us know your thoughts about today's show. Please don't hesitate to contact us at our email address. That's line1@alaskapublic.org. Tell us how we're doing and what you want to hear more of. Next week, Dr. Woodard hosts a discussion about the Youth Risk Behavior Surveillance System, which was developed in 1990 to monitor youth high-risk behaviors that contribute markedly to death, disability, and social problems among youth and adults. It should provide some valuable information about the health and wellness of our adolescent population. So why not tune into Your Health and learn more? Monday, April 13th at 2 p.m., repeating that evening at 9. Pat Yak is the Chief Content Officer for Public Media. Evan Erickson is our web editor and audio engineer for today's show. I really appreciate you tuning in today. I hope that you've enjoyed the show. Until next time, I'm Prentice Pemberton. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.